Welcome to the Suits and Sneakers podcast. Finally, fuck, it's taken long enough. This is where we break down and analyze the key characteristics of successful personalities from around the world. This is your host, Mark Shan. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. In this week's episode, I get to interview Run Neuner. Yeah, that's quite a surname, from the Creative Council. I met Run earlier this year in 2016. He gave me a shout through his PR lady and he wanted to know more about Suits and Sneakers. I happily obliged, went to his offices and learned all about the Creative Council story. And what a story it is. Let me give you some perspective and context. About 12 years ago, Run and Gil pretty much started from nothing as an in-store promotions company, grew it steadily, quietly at first, but starting to make really big waves in recent times, and culminating in the recent sale of their business for about 1.5 billion rand, give or take. That's what the press are reporting. I think that makes Run's story really worth listening to. From what I understand, that's probably one of the largest deals in their industry in Africa. As a patriotic South African, I really think we don't celebrate South African achievements enough and excellence. So I'm really excited that we got to do that in this episode. You'll hear I go all the way back. I want to understand the humble beginnings from Run as a human being. I want to hear what built him, what built his character and personality. And so I really give him a gap to tell his life story on this podcast. But I have no doubt that you're going to enjoy it almost as much as I enjoyed interviewing him. So please take a few moments to sit back, relax, and just enjoy every single detail of the episode and the interview. Hello, my little angel pies, and welcome to the Suits and Sneakers podcast. My name is Mark Sham. I'm your host. I happen to be absolutely obsessed with changing South Africa for the better. And helping me do that today is a fascinating character who, strangely enough, is more fidgety than I am, which is a rarity. So I'd like to welcome none other than Run
Neuner.
There you go. That one's been getting me. Who is famously known for co-founding the Creative Council. But I'm sure by the time we are done with the story, we're going to uncover there's much more to the man than one very fucking amazingly big business. So, hello, Run. How are you?
How's it, Mr. Mark Sham?
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is I've been excited about this for a while, and you've actually been part of the inspiration to kind of put this together.
I think you conned me.
I did.
You did con me.
I did.
You came into my office. You asked me to talk at your Suits and Sneakers event, if I remember. And I remember you're wearing shorts.
Yes.
And what you neglected to tell me was you neglected to tell me that there are going to be 3,000 people there, that you're going to put me on stage with one of my clients and with an imported speaker who's probably the most interesting guy I've ever heard about in my life.
That's I did do that. In fact, I want to go back a step. Do you remember how we met? Before that?
I remember how we met.
Give me
my PR lady, Simone, yes, gave you a call and said, we want Run to speak at Suits and Sneakers.
Yes. I actually, in preparation for this podcast, I went looking through those emails last night. It was quite funny because I kind of knew about you. I knew about Creative Council. And she came very prim and proper to me, like, listen, I've got a client and I'd really like him to speak at this your next event. He has a profile. And then obviously she deets all these these like huge things, the turnover of the company. And so I remember writing back going, well, you make it hard not to talk about this further. Can I catch up with Run? Do you know that I missed our first meeting?
I didn't know that.
I did, but it was a mistake on both our ends. She sent me the wrong meeting request time, and then I landed.
So she's half done her job because she did send you the fact sheets and everything. But.
Okay, so in the spirit of this podcast, I actually want to kind of dive straight into certain things. There's some things that I love asking off the bat, and really, I want to know what makes Run tick. I want to know what is your why? Why do you get out of bed each day? Like, what is driving you present day right now?
So it's a brilliant question, and I'll tell you why it's a brilliant question, because I think I've really changed facets in my life at the moment. I think when I started working, I've got to be honest, I think money was the thing that drove me. So as much as I enjoyed what I was doing, and I said I come to work because I enjoy what I do, I've got to be honest and say that money was the thing that drove me. As everybody knows, last year we sold our business, and things have changed. Subconsciously and mentally, things have changed for me, because clearly I'm not working for money anymore. So now it's really about making a difference and having fun. So you ask, what drives me? My biggest passion in the world is entrepreneurship. I want everybody to have the same ride that I had. I want everybody to have the ups, the downs, the good and the bad, the same way I had them. And that's pretty much why I'm talking to you, because I think that you're going to go through the same ride that I went on. And I believe that I have a story to tell that can change people's lives. People that are on this entrepreneurial roller coaster, I think I can change their lives. And so my purpose, my reason for being, to find smart people, to get involved in their businesses, to back them, to mentor them, and to make sure that we can make as many more entrepreneurs as possible in this country.
That's a really good answer. I guess my question to you is, why do you think, or maybe I'm misunderstanding the situation, why do you think that many people in your situation, people who do very well in business, sell for a lot of money, why does it feel to me that they're not getting more actively involved the way you are? Or do they, and I'm just not seeing it? But it feels like that. Am I wrong?
Look, I think not everybody's passion is entrepreneurship. So I think coincidentally, I am quite a successful entrepreneur, and my passion in life is entrepreneurship. My passion has always been for business. So I think people probably give back in their own ways. I want to give back in a way that actually is not giving back, because it gives me more than I give it, which is seeing other entrepreneurs succeed. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, because I think the biggest compliment I can give you, and you and I have been talking for a while now, so I'm not saying this for the sake of it. I think the biggest thing I can think about is when I tell people, or when people see that you've spoken at some of the smaller events that we've done or whatever, or they see us catching up, you know, there's a certain stature that comes with what you've done. But I always tell them that when you and I get talking, it's like I'm talking to a mate that I've had for 5 or 10 years. Like, you're far more advanced, but this is just kind of like your attitude, nothing's changed.
Exactly, and I think that's really the gist of what my talk is about. Without giving away too much, the gist of what my talk is about is to say, I think that most people are much closer to success than they think. I think they think that people who've sold their business for R1 billion or R1 billion plus are different. Yes. We're not. We're people.
Yes.
We've been luckier. We may have worked a little bit harder, but we're people. And I think if there's one message that I want people to get out of my talk is that from the time that they leave the talk, they can go out and they can actually make it happen, regardless of who they are.
Okay.
Well, I'm really excited. The idea, obviously, even at the time of us recording this is before the Suits and Sneakers main event, but we're releasing this content on the night of the main event, which is pretty cool. So let me go all the way back. I've got a bit of an idea. I think most people will get an idea about you. I kind of want to know all the little things that shaped you. You look like a funny character. You look like when you were a kid, you could have been a handful. So where do you come from? Do you have brothers and sisters? What school did you go to? Were you a nerd? Were you a cocky little fucker? Did you get into fights? Tell me about your earliest memories.
You basically want all the secrets.
Yeah, I want all the secrets.
You want it all, basically.
Like, tell me like your earliest memory.
So let me give it to you very simply. I was born in Israel. I was born to a family of two engineers. And when I was 5 years old, my parents immigrated to South Africa. Or actually, more correctly, they moved to South Africa for a one-year transfer. 35 years later, we're still here. So that one-year transfer lasted 35 years. We're 5 boys in the family, so 4 siblings, all boys. All very different in personality. One is a doctor, 2 develop apps, 1 works for McKinsey. So all very different in personality. Very humble background. My dad was the only guy that worked, so 1 working parent. He was an employee, he wasn't an entrepreneur. Okay. So we grew up in a humble background. 5 kids, all in private schools on 1 person salary.
Sure.
You can imagine that's we didn't have all the luxuries.
Yes.
At school, I was a handful. I had terrible ADD, as I still have. I was terrible at school. I was a troublemaker. I was always the naughty kid. I was expelled for throwing a water bomb onto a teacher. I was expelled for kicking a teacher in the kneecaps. I was that kid. I was thick as pig shit. I failed at school. That was me.
Okay, so
I was always trying to make a buck, though. So, I mean, from the age of 3 and a half, everybody knows the story, but I'll repeat it. At the age of 3 and a half, I learned to use a pair of scissors. I cut out pictures from an old calendar.
Okay.
And I sold them door to door. later on in my life, I started pushing trolleys at Pick and Pay. I was 10 years old, and I was walking around pushing trolleys at Pick and Pay and getting R5 every time, or R2 every time. So I was always operating. I was always trying to make the buck. That was me.
I love
that. It still hasn't changed.
Yeah, I think one of your strengths has definitely been you've got a great eye for opportunity. I am privy to other times where I've heard your story, long format story, and just hearing some of the, like, I remember you saying when you were a little kid, you went missing for a while because you were doing...
You went selling.
And
money was more important.
They're calling the cops and like, where's Ryan? He's
that's me.
Okay, so primary school, high school, like, did you finish school? You said
I finished. I went to two schools. I went to King David School up until Standard 9.
Okay.
And in Standard 9, I was failing dismally because I hated the system. I can't work in systems, any system. In fact, anyone who knows me will tell you that don't tell him what to do or don't put me in a box because I'll just try and find a way out of the box.
Yes.
In matric, I had a point to prove, and I did. I proved the point. I matriculated with an A average and 4 distinctions. Yes. So I really turned the whole thing around, and that was because I did it my way. It was a case of no rules. I went to a college, and there were no rules in the college. You could do whatever you wanted, just write your exams. And that's exactly what I did.
Okay, I love that. So when you got out of school, did you study? What was your vibe?
I did. I studied. So I was a full-time student at WITS. I studied a Bachelor of Commerce degree. I never, ever went to university. I think I went to one lecture over the 6 years that it took me to do a BCom. Yeah, it did take me 6 years to do a BCom. I then finished that, and I did a CFA through an American institute.
Okay. Here's a side random question for you. Do you remember your first girlfriend?
Wow. Yeah, you're asking questions now. But
yeah, like first girlfriend, first kiss. Do you remember those kind of things?
I remember both.
Okay. Before I get into your kind of entrepreneurial career, there's a question that Cal Fussman, who's speaking at Suits and Sneakers in November.
The guy that you imported to take the stage with me.
He did this thing, and I really loved the question, so it's one that I wanted to pose to you. When he had a chance to sit down with Mikhail Gorbachev, he knew he only had like 5 or 10 minutes max with him at the time.
And the first question
he asked was, what's the best lesson your father ever taught you?
Yes.
I think it's really apt since we're going back into your background.
Yes.
Your answer, please.
So I'm going to answer the question by first telling you what my father taught me. But I think father should be referred to as your mentors in life.
Yes.
Now, bear in mind that my dad, he wasn't an entrepreneur. He was a salaried employee. And bear in mind that in my brainwave, in my programming, the concept of working for someone doesn't exist. It never has.
Yes.
I've only ever had one job, and that job lasted for the whole of 4 months. So my father taught me very valuable lessons in life. But the most valuable lesson that my father taught me was not to sweat the small stuff, not to deal with problems until they actually arise. Okay. If you meet my dad's a very chilled guy, and he doesn't sweat the small stuff, and that's his best quality. I had some other mentors in my life. My grandfather. Okay. My grandfather was the closest person in the world to me. He passed a couple of years ago. He taught me humility. He used to tell me that, and he used to teach me that when you go to the bank, you wear your worst outfit so that no one knows that you've got money. And I used to challenge him and say, but granddad, the bank manager knows exactly how much money you've got. He says, yes, but the other people in the bank mustn't.
Okay.
My granddad also taught me the value of education. He forced me to get a degree. How did he force me? He came to me one day and he said, you know, you're not going to ever get a degree. You're never, ever, ever going to get a degree. And I said to him, why do you say that? And he said, you're not smart enough. And I mean, if you want me to get a degree, just tell me I'm not smart enough to get it. And so I went out and I got a degree. So I've had a variety of mentors in my life. I've taken mentorship from where, and that's pretty much what I learned from my two biggest mentors.
Okay, I love that. So in your entrepreneurial journey, I mean, it's obviously one that I can really relate to. I think it's why you and I have gotten along so well so far. Tell me a little bit about some of the first real businesses that you got into. You know, you're done with varsity. Tell me about your early entrepreneurial career.
So I had many business ventures all the time. But let's talk about the real business ventures, so to speak. At university, everyone got their cars, and everyone needed sound for their cars. And I knew how to import sound and how to buy the cheapest gray imports of car radios.
Okay.
And so that was my first business. My first business was called A&R Wholesalers. I did it with a mate of mine called Amir. And we started a wholesale business for electronics. And that was quite a cool business. It carried me through university. It paid the fees. The electronics game then evolved into cell phones, into mobile phones. And I started South Africa's first You Ring, We Bring mobile phone supplier. And that was one of my first businesses, and I sold that business.
Okay.
And that's actually where I made my first R1 million in cash. It was when I sold
that's no small feat. How old were you?
I was 21.
Okay, that's incredible.
It was amazing. It was an amazing ride. But that R1 million that I got, I spent in 2 seconds flat. It was gone. It was one day I had it, and the next day I didn't.
Like, give me some background here. What on earth did you, I mean, I know how easily you could spend R1 million, especially when you don't appreciate the value of what it took to get it.
Yeah.
I assume you must have lost your mind, but like, what on earth did you spend it on?
So let me give you in order to understand what I spent it on, you need to understand where it all came from.
Okay.
So I grew up in a very humble household, where brand names were not an option, where overseas holidays were not an option. How do you, on a one engineer salary, take a whole family overseas, 5 kids. How do you, on one engineer salary, buy brand names for all the kids? So we didn't buy brand names. We used to have always unbranded clothing. So you can imagine that the first thing that I needed to do when I made real money was to buy branded clothing. I used to walk into places like Diesel and everywhere else in Italy or wherever else, and I'd spend thousands of rands on clothing because it was something that I never had before.
Okay.
And then the rest of it, I was quite reckless. I traveled, I went on holidays, I was spendthrift. I'd pay the bills at restaurants. I'd do whatever. Money didn't matter because easy come, easy go. Yeah. I was 21 years old. I was making 10,000 rand a day selling mobile phones. I didn't have an office. I was sitting at a coffee shop in Rosebank with a half-page ad in the newspaper, and that was my life. So easy come, easy go. I get paid R1 million in cash. What do? Naturally, you have to blow it.
Yes.
So I blew it. And remember, we're talking about R1 million
yeah.
cash 20 years ago.
Yes. Yeah.
20 years ago.
Yeah, it's serious bucks.
Serious bucks.
Okay, well played. So that was A&R.
That was A&R, which then became Dr. Cellular. You remember the business card?
I do. Dr. Cellular. Okay, so... You obviously, once they bought it, how long did you stay with them, or did you sell and leave?
I sold and I left, and I was under this thing called the restraint of trade.
Okay.
For those of you who don't know what a restraint of trade is, don't ever sign one, okay? Because it kind of means you're not allowed to do anything that you know how to do ever again.
Yeah.
So sold the business, went overseas, came back wearing a pair of platform shoes, like the old Buffalo platform shoes. You know those Buffalo platform shoes?
I remember them well.
Wearing one of those, came home, sat on the couch, and my buddies came to visit me, and they said, well, what are you doing these days? And I said, I'm not doing anything, because I used to sell cell phones, but now I'm not allowed to anymore. And then they said, oh, cool, those are very nice shoes. And that was my next entrepreneurial idea. I was going to go and import a container of shoes from Israel. And so I got back on the plane that night, literally that night, and I imported a container, well, I found the suppliers, and I ordered 3,000 or 5,000 pairs of shoes from the suppliers.
Oh my God.
And I came back to South Africa to live my bachelor lifestyle. I was living at large. And I came back to South Africa and I lived for 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks. And I got a phone call from my mother. And my mother said to me, did you order a 40-foot container? I was still living in a residential area called Gala Manor. Now you can imagine a 40-foot container truck pulls up at a house, okay? And my mother phones me, I was on a date, and my mother phones me and she says to me, there is a 40-foot container here with your name on it. I'm like, I didn't order any 40-foot containers. She says, it says something about shoes. I was like, oh, the shoes have arrived. I said, you know what, just tell daddy to unpack them and put them in the garage. She said, no, you don't understand. It's a 40-foot container, and it's full of shoes. And so I rushed home with my date, and we started to unpack the shoes from the container into the garages, and eventually into the bedrooms, and eventually into the kitchen, and eventually into the lounge, and the whole house was shoes. And oh, wow. I had two ladies, one which was my date, and one which was someone else, who I gave a pair of shoes to, and I said, you know what, will you please, I've got to thank you. So how can I thank you? I'm going to give you a pair of shoes.
Oh my goodness.
And within 6 weeks, I sold all 5,000 pairs of shoes from my house. People heard that there was this guy selling cheap shoes or good quality shoes for half the price, and it went crazy. And that was my shoe business. And later on in my life, I actually gave the brands or sold some of the brands off to other people, and I left the shoe game. And the reason why I left the shoe game was I realized that you could never be a billionaire selling shoes. I don't know. Have you ever heard of a billionaire who sells shoes?
Yeah, I know.
And that's what I realized. I realized that the amount of shoes that you have to sell to make R1 billion, it's just too many pairs of shoes. And so I got completely demotivated.
I mean, and that's a fascinating mindset, because if I look back at my life, I can divide my whole life into two different people. The first guy would have just been, I would have been totally happy with selling those shoes, making that money. Like, that would have been it. It's only kind of in my late 20s when I caught a skrick about the world and stopped worrying about money. And now I would never be happy with just selling the shoes. But it's amazing that you had that quality, that trait from young. How old were you when the shoe business?
23, 24.
I mean, like, most people would take that and just go, cool, that's a really good lifestyle I'm doing. But clearly it's just not in your setup.
It depends what your ambitions are. And my ambitions have always been to be international and to play in the biggest pond internationally. It's always been that. It's been that since I was a kid.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me to, and I was making a lot of money in the shoes, relative. But
yeah.
For me, I couldn't see the big picture. I couldn't see, number one, I wasn't making a difference to the world. I wasn't making a difference to anyone but wealthy females who could afford to buy R1,000 pairs of shoes. And I was making a big difference in their life, I promise you. A huge difference. Sometimes I was making a difference of 15 centimeters in their lives. That's a huge difference, okay? but you're not really making a difference.
No,
it's in my mind, and apologies if I'm offending anyone, but it's a brainless business. You're buying from someone and you're selling to someone else. And I can't see stimulation in it. And I can't see, you know, you got to have a purpose.
Yeah.
You got to be doing something, in my mind, that's going to change the world.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm not going to be content.
I mean, and I just want to, the caveat is that I can totally relate to it. At about 28, I suddenly found myself only working 6 days a month and making a lot of money relative to what I needed.
And you felt empty.
And I couldn't believe, I'll never forget when it finally dawned, I sat there with lots of money and loads of time. In fact, how suits and sneakers partially came about was out of that time.
So
I sat there going, I'm not doing anything.
Admit that that's probably the most unhappy period of your life.
It was weird.
And you're making money, and it's still the most unhappy period of your life. Yeah.
And I built it up mentally, that when I finally got to that point where I could only work 6 days a month to make more money than most people my age, that would be a particularly happy time. And I think I enjoyed that for like 2 weeks a month, and then I just realized that this was never, I could never continue to do it that way.
Because you got to have purpose.
Alrighty. I mean, this is, it's fascinating. So right about this point in time, the shoe business puts you at 23, 24. You decide no more shoes. You're not going to become a billionaire. Yeah. Where to from there?
Finish my master's equivalent degree in corporate finance and decide that I'm going to become a stockbroker. That
was that always something that was in your head,
no,
rolling around?
Absolutely not. It was a function of the time. All my friends were stockbrokers and they were all making money because in 1997, 98, the markets were really running hard.
Yes.
You could pretty much throw a dart at the newspaper and that share would go up and you'd make money.
Yes.
And so I wanted to be a stockbroker. It was my first and actually my only job, except for now. Now I'm employed. We'll talk about that in a bit.
Yes, we will.
But it was my first and only job, and it lasted for 4 months before they called me into human resources and basically fired me.
Okay, Ron, you know, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm just going to prod and poke, and you don't answer when you don't want to answer, but you need to give me more detail than I was fired.
Imagine that you're a young, short, Jewish guy who walks into a stockbroking firm where the average age is 97 in the shade, and the culture is very, very, very Afrikaans.
Okay.
And imagine that you're the youngest trader at the desk, and your aspirations are actually to buy the firm.
Okay.
After 3 months of being there. Okay. You imagine that you could make some people around you a little bit uncomfortable.
Yes, I agree.
And yeah, that's what happened. I think I made too many people uncomfortable without getting into the detail. Cool. And I got called into a boardroom with HR, and they pretty much asked me what it would cost for me to leave. And we agreed on a figure, and I left.
Okay. And so you obviously know the reason why I'm really trying to get the background here, because I personally have learned so much from podcasts. It's very much the aspiration for this. To understand people's journey, I think that there's so much learning to take from it. So you get fired / asked to leave the stockbroking, and then what happens?
So let's just quickly understand, just put yourself back in 1998. The market's running very, very, very hard. You're a stockbroker. Your job is effectively to manage people's money. By nature, people won't let you really manage their money. They want to get involved, or some people want to get involved. So what do? You get phone calls all day from old ladies going, "Hi, Ryan, what is thy data the share trading at today?" And you say, hi, Sylvia, it's 44 Rand. And she phones you back 5 minutes later, and she goes, "Hi, Ryan, it's Sylvia again." And you can hear fake teeth falling out, and you go, "Hi, Sylvia." And she's like, "Hi, Ryan." And like, "What's that data trading at, Sylvia?" "Nothing's changed. It's still 45 Rand. And so what I realized at the time was that there was this need, or there was no need for a stockbroker, that you could actually do all of this yourself at home. And so we went out and we raised money, myself and my current business partner, Gil, we raised money to go and start South Africa's first online stockbroking portal. At the time, the concept didn't exist, not even internationally. In fact, only once we had started our venture did people like Charles Schwab and E-Trade all launch in the States. And we went out to raise this investment portal, the stockbroking and investment portal. Okay. It was way, way, way ahead of its time. It took us about 2.5 years to develop. We had about 30 developers working on it.
Wow.
And one day we arrived at the office, and there was a padlock on the door, and effectively our business was in liquidation. To cut a long story short, what happened was we raised money from another business. That business went insolvent, and because they were our funders, technically we also went insolvent. And so this dream that we lived and we this dream that we went that we lived through that we led these 30 developers or so down with us ended in one day. And we were down and out. I mean, we had no money. We had invested all our money into the business. We had paid these staff salaries and whatever else. We had no confidence, or certainly I had no confidence. And the worst part is that I was unemployable, because the only thing that I had was a failed venture on my CV. I had nothing else.
Yes.
My friends were all becoming chartered accountants and lawyers. They were all qualifying. They were starting to make 1 million rand. They were all eating sushi. And for me, sushi was way too expensive. Sushi is 300 bucks a head. And if you're not earning anything, you don't have any cash. I was living with my parents again. It was the blackest time in my life. Yeah. And at the time, I had a very beautiful girlfriend whom I'm going to invite to Suits and Sneakers, and hopefully she'll attend, or hopefully she attended. But I had a very beautiful girlfriend, and she was doing promotions. She was doing in-store promotions, she was doing alcohol promotions. She was one of the promoter girls. And I realized that she was making a lot of money, and I was making nothing. I was waking up at 10 o'clock in the morning. I was looking for stuff to do. Inevitably, there was nothing to do, so I'd spend my day at coffee shops or watching videos or whatever it is.
Yes.
And one day I had the idea. I said, if she's making so much money, and her friends are all making so much money doing these promotions, there must be money in the promotions game. So what did I do? I phoned the biggest promotions company in South Africa. Bear in mind, I'm broke at this stage. I've just sold my watch and my golf clubs. Okay, that's how broke I am. I live with my parents. I don't have cash to put petrol in my car. And I phoned the biggest promotions company in South Africa, a company called The Bright Side. And the guy that answers the phone is a guy called Paul Coulson. And I said to Paul, "Hi, you don't know me, but I want to buy your business." Okay. God knows what I would have done if he would have said, "I want to sell you my business," because I wouldn't have even had money for the petrol to go to the meeting. Okay. Anyway, long story short, Paul says to me, "Look, why would I sell you my business? Why? I've got a great business. I'm the biggest in the industry. I make a lot of money. Why would I sell you the business? It would be crazy." So I leave it, and 2 months, 3 months goes by, and I phone Paul again, and I'm still looking for opportunities. I'm going and I'm having lots of meetings with lots of people to have opportunities. And I go to Paul and I say to Paul, I call Paul again. I say, "Paul, how you doing? Just calling to check in on you." And he says to me, "It's terrible. My business is going insolvent."
Wow.
Wow. And I'm like, Paul, what do you mean? You were making so much money. Why are you going insolvent? And he turns around and he says to me, I didn't invoice my clients. Everybody's asking me for cash. I haven't been paid. And therefore, I'm insolvent. I'm like, Paul, you're not insolvent. You just have a cash flow crunch. Meet me at the bank. We'll sort out your cash flow crunch. Long story short, Paul didn't arrive at the bank. Paul went and put his company, The Bright Side, into liquidation. And I phoned him and I said, Paul, where were you? And he said, no, I went to put the company in liquidation. And I said, okay, great. What are you doing tomorrow? He says, I don't know. I said, great. We're starting a promotions company. Meet me at the Hyatt Hotel in Rosebank, at the Hilton or the Hyatt. You know, which one's the one in Rosebank?
Yeah, that's the one.
Meet me there. And on the way, I want you to think of a name. And he met me there. And he thought of it, and I said, and we arrived, and I said, Paul, what's the name of the business? And he said, it's The Creative Council. And I said, great. And that was the beginning of The Creative Council. Now, the funny thing is that we needed money because we had no money. We had no money for office rent, for office space, for survival. We had no money. We didn't have 1 cent. And I went out, and I tried to sell 50% of the business for 100,000 rand. Now, anybody who would have invested that 100,000 rand would have made 750 million rand on that 100,000 rand. But not a single person would give me 100,000 rand. And so what did we do? We did what entrepreneurs must do if they're going to succeed. We bootstrapped. My business partner, Gil, went and got a job. He'd give me his salary check, and I'd pay the rent. I'd pay Paul's salary. I'd pay the internet bills. I'd pay the phone bills. And we were in a terrible office in Hillbrow, Parktown, Hillbrow, actually much more Hillbrow. And that was our first, the beginning of Creative Council.
Wow.
And 15 years later, we sold the business for what the press says is anything between 1 and 1.5 billion rand. I can't confirm or deny if the press is true because I signed an agreement that says I'm not allowed to. But I'd say that most of the times you shouldn't believe what you read. In this case, you can.
Yes, man, I love that. And this is, I love hearing these stories because you're right. There's an audacity to the whole thing. Like calling someone up and saying, listen, I'm going to buy your business, or I want to buy your business. It's just ludicrous.
So someone once asked me, no, everybody looks to me for the secret formula in success. I go and I obviously give a lot of talks, like this Suits and Sneakers, like a whole lot of other talks. And they ask me what the secret is to success. And whenever they ask me that, you find that everyone pulls out their notepads and it's like they're ready. Like they're going to write down 5 points and then they're going to apply the 5 points and they're going to succeed just like I did. The truth is there's no formula. My formula was probably 90% luck and the rest of it was hard work. But there is one quality that I believe that if you don't have, you're not going to succeed. And I call that quality dog fuck.
Okay.
So I know I'm not supposed to be swearing.
This is a swear-friendly podcast.
Great. So we created what we call the dog fuck index. So I think first you have to understand, you have to understand what dog fuck actually is. Okay. So dog fuck is a term that we coined or that one of our partners coined. And it's around a dog that's going to fuck another dog. Now, have you ever seen a dog that's going to fuck another dog?
I've seen several.
Now, you can spray them with a hose pipe. You can hit them with a rake. You can smack them with a broom. That dog, it's got one vision, one thing, right?
Yes.
What's that thing?
Yeah.
To go and fuck the other dog. Yes. That's what it is. So actually what I think I mean is, I mean that there are certain people that nothing matters to them except the end goal. And the end goal is wealth, success, making a difference. And they are so focused in their approach that no matter what comes at them along the way, it's like water off a duck's back or a dog's back. And that's exactly what it is. So I can't say that there's a secret formula for success, but I can tell you that I back people that have dog fuck and people that have failed. Okay, I don't back people that have succeeded because I believe that you learn nothing from success. You only learn from failure. The only thing, success is evil. You know why success is evil? Because success, and especially quick success, makes you arrogant.
Yeah.
And arrogant people don't learn anything. And so I think that I've had a very tough ride. I've had businesses in liquidation. Creative Council was in liquidation in its early days because of an administrative error. And I only ever learned every lesson that I ever learned, I learned from a failure.
Yes.
And so part of the things that I preached, as you would have heard in my talk, is I encourage people to fail. Because if you don't fail, you fail to succeed. And I'll tell you why. The word innovation. So I believe that if you want to succeed, you've got to innovate. You can't do what everybody else is doing. And by definition, the word innovation means that you've got to try to do things that have never been done before.
Yes.
And if you do that, it means that you're going to fail 8 times and you're going to only succeed once or twice. And so for me, it's very important that we celebrate failure. Because the more times a person has failed, the more lessons they've learned.
Yeah, you know, obviously you're preaching to the choir in this regard. I've always related to that. I've put myself in some really hair-raising positions. But the point of what I'm about to say is, I'm really learning the value lately of not waiting for something to sting and reflecting on it for 3 years to learn its value. So if I can give you an example, something bad would happen to me 3-4 years ago. It would take me a year to recover. Like, how could that happen? Then I'd look back later and go, oh, wow, there's some real valuable things that actually came from that, because if that didn't happen, then this didn't happen. And what I've managed to do in recent times is shorten the time frame. So when bad, in fact, to the point that even a few weeks ago, when things are getting like seriously hair-raising, I'm starting to say to myself, okay, so I'm in a shitty space, something good's happening. Like, I must be, something good must be coming from this really shitty space.
So I bet you that when you were in the down, or when you've just failed, you kind of look at yourself and go, how am I ever going to get up from this?
Yeah.
I want to refer you to a story of a person that I have a lot of respect for in business, a gentleman by the name of Natie Kirsch. So I'm sure you've heard of Natie Kirsch. Natie Kirsch, at the age of 50, lost everything. 50. To lose everything at the age of 50. Today, he's probably one of the 100 wealthiest people in the world.
Wow.
He's probably in his 70s or his 80s. Now, how do you get up at the age of 50 after you've lost everything in your life?
Yeah, that must be brutal.
And get up to the point that you can fight again and become one of the wealthiest people in the world. Okay, now it shows that A, it can be done. But it shows that a real champion, someone who's got dog fuck, will get up no matter what, at no matter what age, because there's simply no other alternative.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned it. I think why part of the reason why I tell people to fail is because you've got to learn to fail, and you've got to learn to get up fast, and you've got to learn to dust yourself off quite quickly. Listen, I fail every day. I make mistakes in our business every single day. Now, you're nodding as if you understand, but let me tell you what you don't understand. I have 1,000 people that work in my business. Okay? The decisions that I make influence 1,000 people's lives, 1,000 people's families. Just think, every morning I come to work, I make decisions. There's 1,000 people. They've all got families, husbands, wives, kids. I make a mistake, which makes the company perform badly. It means that of those 1,000 people, 100 may be affected, and their families, and their kids. Okay, now that's what you call responsibility. Now, I fail and make mistakes every single day. Every day I fail and I make mistakes. What do? I've got this amazing ability to get up so quickly and to think rationally under pressure.
Yes.
I'm a member of an organization called YPO, Young Presidents Organization, and part of YPO is education events. One of the education events that YPO hosted a couple of years ago in the States was they made you join the Navy SEALs training camp, and specifically the Navy SEALs training camp module around torture. Now you ask yourself, why would they take CEOs to train with Navy SEALs, and specifically in the torture part of the thing? Because what they want to teach you is that even when you're at the worst, when you're at your worst, when you've been tortured, when you've been beaten, how to continue to function.
Okay.
And that's one of the things that one of the qualities that you learn from failure.
I don't even know if there's anything to add to that. I think that's perfectly put. I think anybody who's been on the entrepreneurial journey for a while and who's doing things will totally attest to what you're saying. It's just the gospel. Right, ladies and gentlemen, I thought that we could take a small break and use this opportunity to put the spotlight and attention on a small business owner or young entrepreneur. This will become a steady feature of our podcast, because small businesses are the engine room of our economy. So today, our feature showcases a very interesting lady named Jess Brown, who is a hairstylist and cuts my hair. I've gotten to know her really well over the last few months, and I thought this was a great opportunity to give back to the community. So I'd like you to just take a few seconds, or a few minutes, should I say, calm your farm, to enjoy getting to know Jess Brown, who she is, what she does, and make contact when you're done. Without further ado, Jess Brown, everybody. Alrighty, so who on earth am I sitting across from?
Jess Brown.
And Jess, what on earth do you do?
Okay, so I'm a master stylist at Colton Hair, Sandton City, and I have my own hashtag Jess Time.
I've actually seen a few of those on Facebook. Mm-hmm. We know each other because you happen to be the wonderful human being that cuts my hair, has to deal with the mop times. Tell me, for 2 seconds, a little bit of a background. How did you get into doing what you do?
It was actually a client who suggested the hashtag. You want to know about that?
Well, both. How okay. did you kind of get into what
so
you do?
So I've been with Colton for 11 years.
Okay.
And the only way I could...
But you look 18, Jess.
He's
you're
so
like
sweet.
Nine when
He's
you...
He's so sweet.
Okay, I'm winning.
Yeah, so I was doing a learnership at Colton. I studied full-time. And I just loved learning. And in that sense, I became a teacher. So I teach, and in that way, I also teaching some of the girls how to promote themselves via media, taking yes. pictures, connecting, you know, hashtagging, teaching them how to do that.
I think what's going to happen is from here, once people start looking out for the hashtag Jess Tom, they're going to see it all over the show. Because
yeah.
that's kind of what happened to
exactly.
you and I started
yeah.
seeing it all over the show.
So the cool thing about the hashtag is someone just types in hashtag Jess Time and it'll take them straight to exactly where I am, which salon, how long I've been a stylist for. It gives them all the information and pictures of my work. So people then come for appointments then. So that's a clientele basis.
So are you based at one specific Colton? Do you move around?
I'm at one Pacific Colton in Sandton City. I have been at Rosebank for a year, but I love Sandton because it's just where everything is.
So I always have to ask people this question, but where do you see things happening from here for you? Like, give me a kind of a picture of your mind's eye for the next, I don't know, 2 to 3 to 5 years.
So I am enjoying the media events, enjoying the shows, backstage, probably my own brand company along hairdressing lines, which would be awesome, and teaching. I love teaching.
Yeah, and I must say, obviously, because you and I have a bit of a relationship, I think that you're well set out for it. You've got that persona, you get the media, there's no question about it. It was definitely one of the reasons why I thought that you should come tell the whole world about who you are and what you do. So I think that when you talk about learning, just give me a quick idea of some of the rituals that you have with regards to learning.
So it would be at our Colton Hair Academy. We have classes there. And I would do once a week training. And apprentice, on-hands apprentice. So that's the best way to actually learn, right?
So some quick fire questions before you go. How old are you?
31.
Okay. Involved or single?
Involved.
Okay. Well, at least now we know to leave the cricket bats behind and everybody doesn't have to get jumped in. And lastly, I guess the question I'm burning to ask you is, if you were going to start your own business, do you have a name for it?
Yes, I do.
Have a
hashtag
go.
Jess Time.
Oh, there we go. There we go. Jess, thanks so much for being part. I hope that everybody who's listening checks you out. Where can they find you on social media channels?
So it's hashtag Jess Time on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Jess Time.
And you're open to people following you across all the channels?
Follow me. I love it.
Jess, thanks so much for being part of the Small Business Showcase. And I hope everybody gets their huts in gear and just goes and supports Jess Brown.
And come get a haircut. Thank
well,
you.
That too.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. And that was our Small Business Showcase for the episode. Let's get back to hearing what Ron has to say about the world. And go. So you mentioned early days of the Creative Council that you nearly went, you nearly liquidated
yeah, sure.
because of some administrative details. Do you want to elaborate?
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about failure. I'd love to hear about that failure.
Let me tell you a few stories. The first story is about being penny wise and pound foolish. So when we started Creative Council, I met this amazing bookkeeper. She told me she charges 25 grand a month. I said, I can't afford 25 grand a month. I did the books myself in Excel. I used to do the VAT claim returns myself in Excel. And then the business grew and grew and grew and grew and grew. And I couldn't keep up. And so I fell behind. And then I took the same lady and I paid her double to catch up on the on all the times that she, that I fell behind. The problem was that she couldn't catch up because the business was moving forward like a steam train. Yes. And she was trying to catch up and it was impossible. And one day the receiver of revenue walks into Creative Council and says, "We're coming here to audit your VAT." And we looked at each other and we're like, oh, this is the end. This is the end. And they ran a full audit on Creative Council and on Run and Gill. And at the time, we landed up paying hefty penalties because of our admin was in a mess. I'll give you another great example of how terrible our admin was. We bought our company from a company called The Shelf Warehouse. That's where you buy shelf companies. Yeah, yes, you know what a shelf company
is? I bought a company from The Shelf Warehouse.
Okay, so it's a company that no one's using and it sits on the shelf. And so we bought this company, but we never changed the registered address of the company. And so one day this lady created an invoice for services that she never, ever, ever fulfilled. And she sent the invoice to the shelf company warehouse. And they just tore up the invoice and put it in the dustbin. And so she went to court and the court issued a summons. And it went to the shelf company warehouse. And so they threw it in the dustbin. And so the court date came and we never went to court because we never knew about it. And so the magistrate ruled against us because we weren't there. And the next day, and then they published a notice of provisional liquidation in the Citizen newspaper. Now, do you read the Citizen? No. I don't.
Yeah.
So I never read the notice of provisional liquidation. And then one day in December, in our busiest time, I get a phone call. Now, when I say to you busy, I'm having meetings every 15 minutes. I'm going on holiday in a week. I'm burning 1 million rand in cash every day in staff wages. And I get a phone call from reception downstairs and it says, there's a gentleman by the name of Jaap Olufse here to see you. I'm like, look, I don't have a meeting with Jaap Olufse and my diary's very full. And I put the phone down. Get a phone call again. And she says, look, I think you want to meet Mr. Olufse. So I'm like, I'm very busy. I can't. I've got meetings every 15 minutes. And I put the phone down again. And the third time she called, I realized that I had to meet Mr. Olufse. And I went downstairs and I went to meet Mr. Jaap Olufse. And Mr. Jaap Olufse had a notice of liquidation. And he came and he said, look, actually this business now belongs to me. I'm the liquidator. And you guys are in liquidation. I'm like, but we're not in liquidation because we have money in the bank. And he said, no, but you didn't go to court, so you're actually liquidated. And that mistake, we had to go to court, that process must have cost us over 1 million rand. And that was for an invoice of 15,000 rand that wasn't even a real invoice. So yes, we've made mistakes along the way. A lot of them have been administrative. We make many mistakes every day, but we learn from our mistakes.
Wow. As I'm sitting here listening to you tell these stories, I'm just relating to about 1 million different things that I've done wrong, because it sounds like every entrepreneur who's worth his salt had a shitty setup with his accounting, like something random that he's like.
If I could go back, the finance and the systems would be the first thing that I fixed. The first thing, if I could go back, and in my next venture, I promise you that my finances and my systems will run way ahead of myself.
Yeah.
Because I've learned my lessons.
Yeah. And again, I'm just sitting here taking it all in and just totally relating.
When someone says to you, I've lost hundreds of millions of rands as a result of bad systems, you need to believe me that when I say hundreds of millions, the number is in the hundreds of millions of rands I've lost because of bad admin.
Okay. So I'm fully with you around failures, etc. But let's talk about the upside, okay? Because there are not many deals like this to be celebrated that I certainly know of in your industry and in terms of what you do. So clearly what's happened between then and now is that you got over those hurdles, the humps. And let's talk about the momentum that then started swinging the other way. You went from an in-store promotions company, in effect.
Yes.
This thing grew.
Yeah, it grew. We can spend hours and hours and hours talking about how Creative Council grew. And I think that might be another discussion for another time, because that's 15 years of a work career and making something grow. Let's say a few things. The first thing is there was no strategy for Creative Council. There should have been, but there wasn't. We grew because out of necessity. Now, a lot of entrepreneurs are too gung-ho on strategy. A lot are not gung-ho enough on strategy. We grew because we needed to grow. And we grew in the direction in which the market took us. We built a great business. We were two young guys. We were immature. We broke a lot of people along the way. We were bad leaders. I think we're better leaders now. We learned a lot of mistakes. Very important to understand that we never had a mentor or mentors, and we never worked in a corporate. So it was almost like walking into a forest, and every step forward that we took meant that we ourselves had to chop down the trees. No one had been there before us.
Yes.
That's the analogy.
It's a great analogy.
But we built an amazing business. It's an amazing, amazing business. It has amazing people. Our management team is incredible. People like Elizabeth Miller, Elizabeth Kiva, she's married, Varusha, Joash, Anya, Alicia, Michelle. We've got a fantastic, fantastic Heidi. We've got a fantastic, fantastic management team. And they're really the guys that carry our business now.
How did it work out in the last few years that the company Publicis?
Publicis, yeah.
Describe, things are moving along quite nicely, and tell me about the first time you get wind of the idea that your business, that someone was interested in buying your business at this level.
I'll tell you a funny story. So we know there's a land grab in Africa. The international agencies all want Africa, and we are the biggest agency in South Africa, and South Africa is the entry point into Africa. So my business partner Gil gets a phone call from a guy called Larry Katz, and Larry Katz says, I've got a buyer for your business. And Gil says, we're not selling. And Gil puts the phone down. And then Larry phones me, and my philosophy in life is that you've got to take every call and you've got to give everybody a chance. And anybody that will mail me will know that I eventually do reply to every single email that I get, even if it's a person that I've never met. And I meet Larry, and Larry says, look, I can sell your business. And this is the number I can get for it. And I'm like, cool, let's sell it. And I come back and I convince Gil, and Gil says, I want to have nothing to do with it. Good luck. And so I try and sell the business. And the first time we tried to sell our business, the deal fell through. And then we had a board meeting. And in the board meeting, the board voted that I must stop trying to sell the business because it's a waste of time. And of course, I didn't listen to the board. And I carried on trying to sell the business, and I managed to revive the deal. And we then entered into 2 years of negotiations. It took us 2 years of the toughest 2 years of my life negotiating a deal. And 2 years later, as you know, on the 2nd of September in 2015, our business was sold to the Publicis Group.
Wow. 2 years of negotiations.
2 years of negotiations.
You know, the curiosity in me is so wanting to understand those details. 2 years. What, you're full of stories, so give me some perspective there in what's happening. Is it kind of like...
The first thing is that you have to go on a courtship with your potential buyers, which is what we did. We lured three big buyers to come and look at our business. And then we got them to start playing off each other.
Okay.
And then what happens is you sign a letter of intent, which is called an LOI, which essentially binds you to one of the buyers and binds you to... They say, we're interested in buying your business. And you say, cool, we're interested in selling you our business. That's essentially what a letter of intent is. And then you lock everybody else out for a period. And then they do what's called a due diligence. A due diligence is when they look under your skirt. They look at your financials. They look at your staff. They look at the market. They look at everything else. And then they come back to you with a formal offer. And then you negotiate the formal offer. And in our case, at the time, our buyers had completed another big acquisition. And so they weren't focused on our acquisition. And so this goes on for 2 years. I mean, these things take long. I mean, the due diligence takes 6 months. And then there's, of course, there's a whole lot of like curves and roundabouts in this in a negotiation that's curveballs. But I mean, I learned how to build a business for sale, and I learned how to sell a business, and that's something that I can take with me.
Yeah, I mean, I can totally imagine when it first started getting serious. So you signed, let's say, the letter of intent with each other. Mm-hmm. Is it hard to concentrate on going through everyday life while this thing is...
It's the hardest time in the world because
I can imagine.
Your focus is 100% on selling the business. To the extent that your clients suffer, to the extent that your business suffers, your staff suffers, I think we were kind of lucky that there were two of us and that one could focus on the business while the other could focus on the sale. But it's very, very hard. And also, you have to try and understand the psyche. You've built this thing. It's going to be sold. On the one hand, you know, it's quite hard to let something that you've built go. It's like a child, a 15-year-old child. On the other hand, you want to sell it. So there's this tug of war. It's an emotional tug of war. It's physically very, very taxing because you're working double hours, essentially. So as you can imagine, it's quite a tug of war.
Okay, so it actually ties in perfectly. Most of our conversation has just been exactly that, it's conversation. But I did put some things down here that I wanted to take notes. And ironically, the next thing that I wanted to take note of was, I've even written here, it's quite cool. I said, okay, so let's talk partnership. You didn't create this alone.
Yes.
Right? And Gil is obviously a big part of your life and the narrative that you have. So tell me a little bit about you and Gil, but more what I'm really trying to get is tell me what you've learned about partnership.
So let's take the history is Gil and I were school friends. We were the fiercest of competitors ever since school, whether it was for the results, the grades, whether it was for the girl, whatever it is, we've always competed. That competition is what got us to where we are today, because I competed with him and he competed with me, but we were in the same business. So it's almost like your biggest competitor sits right next to you.
And it drove you
and
guys
And it drives us. And by the time we looked back, we were so far ahead of the industry that it was ridiculous. It's quite tricky as to what my thoughts are on partnership. So we've had a great partnership. But partnership is quite hard. It's like marriage. We are like two people that are married and we have a child called the Creative Council. And whether or not we love each other anymore doesn't matter because we have a child called the Creative Council and we have to do what's right for the business. I think there's great merit in partnerships. I think the most important thing in looking for a partner is not seeing what value they can add to the business today. I see a lot of startup businesses that say, you know, he's my developer, so I'm going to bring him as my partner. No, that's the wrong reason to bring someone into a business. A partner is like a marriage. A partnership is like a marriage. If you get divorced, it's very, very, very ugly. And so what you want to try and do is you want to try and find a partner that is like-minded, that has the same value system, the same culture, the same integrity. That's what you want to look for in a partner. The rest will come.
And you'll evolve in many different ways together.
100%. Look, we've had a fantastic partnership. Our partnership has been going for longer than 20 years, which I think is a rarity. But now Creative Council's finished, and I mean, we're both pursuing our own directions. Some of it is together, some of it is apart. We had a great run.
Yeah, again, my very next question to you was, I'd love to hear where your head's at around other things, other investments, other businesses, because everybody right now, so I walked into the Woolies the other day, and the first thing I saw as I walked in that night is you and Gil on the cover of Destiny Mag.
Yes.
And I've been doing a lot of online research about you purely because I've been writing some stuff about you for Suits and Sneakers. And so whenever I listen to, I read interviews about you, like everybody's just talking about the Creative Council, given, I granted, but I kind of want to know a little bit more outside of, even right now, outside of the Creative Council, what's turning you on, what you're involved in.
Yeah. So I think let's separate my life into my wife and my mistress. So my wife is Creative Council. And I love Creative Council dearly, and I've got to look after my wife and make sure that this business grows. And when I sell, and when we eventually one day leave, that we've fulfilled on all of our obligations and we've given publicists an amazing, amazing, amazing business. That goes without saying. As to what the future holds for me, my biggest focus is on investing. When I say investing, maybe not always financially, in young, smart people and helping them make sure that the journey that they go through is the same as mine but without all the bumps. So my passion
with and without the bumps.
Yes,
I'm with you.
But my passion is watching people succeed. I just want people to succeed, and if I can be a part of it, great. If I can't be a part of it, I can help people succeed, that's great. You know, I want other people to succeed. Young, smart, hardworking people must succeed.
And them succeeding is good for you. It's good for me. Straight up, how old are you?
41.
I mean, that really leaves you with a long time. And in fact,
I feel like I've got I'm running against the clock.
Yeah, yeah, sure. But what's going to really happen here is the second this all comes to a close, when you do eventually leave your wife.
Yes. I'm not leaving my real wife.
Yeah, it's not your real wife, your business wife. There will be a time of breathing, and then it'll be, I can just picture.
There's no breathing. I am already focused on finding the young talent. I'm already obsessed with it. There's no time to stop.
But I mean, you really do have a long,
Mark,
that's so ahead of you.
You and I don't enjoy holidays. Yeah. Right? Because this is not like a holiday for us.
Yes.
Business is, you know, if you enjoy business more than anything else in the world, even more than a skiing trip or more than lying on a beach, then, you know, when I lie on a beach, it's the second best thing that I want to do. Because the best thing I'll tell you a very funny story. I can't lie on a beach for obvious reasons. And so the one year I was in Thailand and I was lying on the beach and I got bored and I went for a walk. And I walked past, in Thailand they have these trolleys that change money, they money exchange trolleys. And what I realized was that if you took rands and you used the rands to buy baht and used the baht to buy euro and used the euro to buy your rands back, there was an arbitrage if you walked between the one trolley and the other trolley. So every morning I'd wake up in the morning and say, how much money do I need today? And I'd take the rands and I'd spend the rands and I'd do a round trip and I'd eventually come out with more money. Okay, because they weren't sophisticated enough to work out the arbitrage. Okay? Anyway, eventually they all ran out of rands because somebody was taking, and then there was no more rands, and then you couldn't carry on doing this. But I'm saying, so when you enjoy operating so much,
yes,
there's nothing more that you want to do. There's no time for a break. There's no such thing as a break.
I love that. Yeah, two things. We've got a mutual friend, John Sarno, who will be on this podcast, and he's got a saying which I love. He says, when work is more fun than fun.
Yes.
I love that. And two, you know, I've got this obsession about travel, which I'm going to get into with you a little bit later. But I've realized that as blindly obsessed as I am with travel, I have a 10-day cap. And ultimately, what I have to start doing, and then that's what I've started doing already, is I have to turn the travel trips into business trips.
Yeah,
they're becoming that. Then I'm in my element. Like, I agree with you. The idea of, the last time I realized, I went to Thailand 3 years ago. For 3 weeks, I joined friends. I was the only guy sitting there after about 10 days going, I'm going nuts. I have to get home. And everybody
mocked
me.
When work is more fun than fun.
So I have two interesting questions that kind of lead into each other. You spoke about the lack of mentorship up until a certain point. But right now, as you sit here with everything you've done, do you have mentors now, or do you have people that you look up to? And tell me a little bit about them.
So I don't have specific mentors, but I am part of a very good organization called Young Presidents Organization, or YPO, which is a collective of CEOs from 25,000 CEOs from around the world.
Yes.
And I have a great bunch in South Africa, my forum buddies, and I'm part of Entrepreneurs Organization, and I've got 10 or so forum buddies in that organization. And between those guys are the guys that carry me through my unknowns. And I think those organizations are fantastic. They do amazing things for entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I can really relate. Again, always, but it's one of the reasons why I started Suits and Sneakers. There's a real value in getting like-minded people together regularly.
Well, you'll notice that my talk at Suits and Sneakers was called Don't Buy My Book. And the reason why the talk's called Don't Buy My Book is because this type of shit you can't learn from a book.
Yes.
And that's why I probably never write a book, because you can't learn this from a book. You need to hear it from someone. You need to hear the emotion behind it. You need to hear, when I tell you that I went into liquidation one day, you need to see the fear in my face when you're burning R1 million a day and you go into liquidation.
Tell me a little bit about your daily routine, be that as unorthodox as it may be. Are there some things you or your rituals? I mean, that's what I really find successful people interesting, because of the different things that they do.
I'm not a ritualistic person. I've discovered the value of balance, which most entrepreneurs don't learn until very late. You know, everyone thinks that the harder you work, the more money you make. That's not true. The harder you think, the more money you make. And the time, you know, for me, I had an epiphany the one day, and that came in the form of, I was flying from Cape Town to Joburg, and that's a 2-hour flight, and my laptop battery was dead, and my phone battery, well, you can't use your phone in the air. And I realized that I solved more of my problems in that quiet 2 hours than I did in the entire week or 2 weeks or month before that.
Yeah.
And so I really appreciate the value of balance. So you ask me what I do, I wake up very early in the morning, and I've got a little baby, I've got a 10-month-old baby, and he wakes up and I spend the morning with him. I spend a couple of minutes, maybe an hour in the morning with him before he goes back to sleep. I'm at the office, I'm an early bird. I like to be at the office by 7. I work very quickly, so my PA will usually schedule a 15-minute meeting with me, with everyone. Because if you can't get to the point in 15 minutes, you're wasting time. And I do that for the whole day, and then I often have think time in my diary where I just sit and I Facebook, I surf, I read articles, because that's your think time. It's the time that you allow your mind to drift.
Yes. That makes perfect sense. So on the note of Facebook, we are friends on Facebook.
Yes, we are.
I always look forward to when I see Run's name, because I know that some cocky, chirpy comment is going to come out. Do you enjoy, is it just a Facebook thing? Do you enjoy your social media across, are you on other channels? Take on social media?
I love Facebook because I think that one day every single transaction that we make is going to be made through a Facebook platform, because Facebook is the one platform that knows everything about us. It knows who we like, who our friends are, what clothes we wear, when we fill up petrol. It knows everything about us.
Yes.
So for me, I love Facebook. I'm not ashamed to say it. I probably spend the majority of my day on Facebook in some form or another. I skip the bullshit, and I use it to read interesting articles. I use it to connect with interesting people, etc., etc.
And in fact, I try to tell so many people this about social media. You can really set up your channels, your news feeds,
yes,
in a specific way.
Yes.
You can create multiple news feeds of just. It's a great place for interesting content to come to you in one central place instead of you having to always go find it.
Yes.
No, so I love that part. And also, social media for me is a very interesting, it gives you an interesting point of view, because you're watching real life people at play. It's like research.
I don't know how we survived without it.
Me too.
I don't know how we ever survived without it. I mean, it's the best gift that we've ever got. It's just made us so much more connected, so much more global. Things happen so much quicker. Businesses start quicker. Businesses fail quicker. I don't know what we ever did without it. I use it as a social tool. I use it as a business tool all the time.
Alrighty. So what I want to do is I want to shift gears a little bit, and I want to talk about some things that are close to the heart of suits and sneakers, which I always love to get your opinions on, and then we'll kind of close up. So one is around education. What is your take on Fees Must Fall, which is a topic that may seem irrelevant in a while, but I don't think so. I think that Fees Must Fall there's a bigger problem at play. And I want to kind of hear your thoughts on Fees Must Fall and also education as a whole. Why are we experiencing the problems that we are in South Africa? What do we do?
Let's start with the second question first. Why are we experiencing what we're experiencing? Poor leadership. Where are the leaders at this time? I think it's also a function of, you know, in politics, a lot of empty promises are made. I think empty promises were made to the students that we've all seen the free education posters. And I know that there'll be a spin as to what it is. My take on Fees Must Fall, though, is a controversial one. One, I think that you cannot mess with the student market if you want to be the power in party, the party in power. You can't mess with the student vote because they're the future leaders. And I think that the ANC has done a hell of a lot of damage with the future leaders. I think the way in which the students are going about this is they're cutting off their nose to spite their face, because I think that they're not getting educated, they're not going to get into the workplace, they're stalling themselves and the whole country, and I think it's very, very unfortunate. But I take it all back to one thing: bad leadership.
And so your thoughts on formal education as a whole, do you feel like the ground is shifting beneath the feet of formal education?
In some cases, yes. I think that formal education is a must.
Yes.
I think that there's a problem. So, A, it's your entry ticket into the game. But more than that is, if you don't have formal education, I find that people get quite insecure about the fact that they don't have formal education. Now, that can manifest in a number of different ways. Either because they don't have a formal education, they are so hungry that they're out to prove that they're going to beat everyone with a formal education, or they become insecure. And if they become insecure about it, then it may ruin your confidence in the workplace. For me, personally, my kids are going to get a formal education. Having said that, you've got to be quite smart about where you get the formal education from, because the world is moving much faster then textbooks can be written.
Yeah.
And the problem is that what you learn in university, the day you leave university, is already obsolete.
Yeah, you're so lucky.
So university has got to teach you how to think. And if university teaches you how to think, then you've got to really choose your university quite smartly.
That's a really good answer, and I can appreciate that.
Maybe there's scope for the university of suits and sneakers.
It's fine, and now we're talking. And I have so much more to tell the world about that, but I'm not going to use this opportunity straight away. But your head's in the right place. So it leads me kind of down to the place around South Africa as a whole. I know you're talking about bad leadership, and I totally agree with you. We have similar views in that regard. How do we? Because I think we've gotten to a point where I can't control government, and they're going to do what they're going to do for the next while. Yeah. So how do we, how do you and me, how do the people around this table, how do we fix, how do businesses fix the country? What would you do?
Look, it's very hard. I mean, as we are recording this, our finance minister is going to be interrogated for fraud. We know that there's a faction within our ruling party. I don't really mind what the politicians do, as long as they don't make it more difficult for business to work.
Yes.
And what's currently happening is they're making it impossible for business to succeed. They're doing so much damage that it's actually impossible for business to succeed. And you ask me what business people can do, I'm not going to spin you as if I have a real answer for that, because I don't, because I've been racking my brain thinking, what can we do? I find that business has become powerless. You know, when the most that business can do is accompany Pravin Gordhan to court, 81 CEOs have vowed to accompany Pravin Gordhan to court, what's that going to achieve? It just shows you how powerless we are, even how powerless big business is. But I believe that there's a positive out of all of this. And I think that the positive is that the ANC is digging their own grave and that they're paving the way for real democracy and real change. And I think we saw the beginning of that in the local government elections.
Yeah, that it's spot on with that. Shifting gears again, if we're going to talk about the negative, what are the things you love most about South Africa?
Cape Town.
Yeah. Dot, and?
So I love Cape Town. I love the people in Cape Town. Obviously, I love Cape Town itself. Really like that. We have a great entrepreneurial spirit in South Africa, which I really, really love. I think that's pretty much the loves for me. I think it's a beautiful country. I think geographically it's a fantastic country. With 1 hour you can fly to Durban, with 2 hours you can fly to Cape Town, with 1 hour you can fly into the bush. That's unique. You're not going to get that anywhere else in the world. That's really amazing.
The reason why you hear my hesitation really is I'm processing everything that you've kind of said. Where do you see yourself 5 to 10 years from now?
Changing the world. My next venture cannot be linear and must have a bigger purpose than making money. Simple as that. I'm not interested in getting involved in any business where you have to work harder to make more money. I don't think that the owners of Uber work harder to make more money. I think it's just a case of more people using the app. So not linear, and something that's going to change the world. I'm not doing anything small.
We have we've had a fairly good go, and I've been thinking about how long or short I want to keep these podcasts. So I think now's the time that I kind of want to bring it to an end. I'm definitely going to have you on for a round two call it 6 to 12 months. I think it'll be interesting to dive into the detail once people have heard this podcast, seen you talk at Suits and Sneakers and many other things. But here's a question that I want to end the note on, and it's a very personal one to me. So let's pretend I gather every single South African into the biggest room, okay, hypothetically, and I can make them all quiet and down for this time, and I can give them, their full attention. So you walk up on the stage, the microphone's on, you've got the attention of every South African for, say, 3 or 4 minutes, and the stage is yours. What do you say?
I'm glad you asked that question, because it's something that's been racking my brain for a long time. And the reason why it's been on my mind for a long time is because when I go into Africa, and Africa doesn't hold the same promise as South Africa. I mean, if you look at Nigeria, their currency is devalued much worse than ours. But the people are positive and forward-looking and forward-thinking. Same thing with Zim. The Zimbabwean people have gone through the worst run in the world. But they're forward-thinking and forward-looking. The biggest problem, the biggest crutch that we have in South Africa is the fact that we keep looking backwards. We keep trying to make right the wrongs of the past. We can't make right the wrongs of the past. It's happened. I believe that we must try and make right the wrongs of the past through things like real transformation in this country. Real, not play transformation, put a black person and give him a title. Real transformation where economic benefit lies in the hands of the people that gave it all up or were forced to give it up in the past. That said though, as a nation, if we want to succeed, if there's any chance we want to succeed, we've got to start looking forward. We cannot keep looking backwards.
Ron, what an excellent answer. I really want to say thank you very much for your time. Really, really, it's been fascinating. I am fucked up excited for people to kind of hear this podcast. I think what a great way to kick the whole thing off. I've learned lots. I'm definitely having you back in 6 to 12 months. By the time anybody else is listening to this, Ron would have already have spoken. So, in a forward and back looking way, good luck with your talk. And whoever's listening, I hope you enjoyed his talk. At the same time, thanks for being part of the journey. Do you want people to get hold of you? How do people get hold of you?
So yes,
social media, those kind of things.
I'm on Facebook. I'm also on run@creativecouncil.co.za. Simple as that. Mail me with good ideas, good businesses. As I said, I do get back to everyone. So
Ron, thanks very much for your time. I hope everybody had a good time listening to this, and we will catch up with you a little bit later.
Thank you, Mr. Sham, and thank you, Suits and Sneakers.
So that's it for this week's episode, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed Ron's story. I'm sure you'll agree that go-getting attitude that he has, that never say die attitude, is for the win. Before you all skedaddle on your merry own ways, I just want to give props to two companies who bring this whole podcast together. The first is a company called Word of Mouth. That's W-O-R-D-E, Word of Mouth. And without them, this podcast would sound like we've recorded the whole episode in a bath somewhere. It would sound really shit, like most other podcasts do. We've decided to do it professionally, but wouldn't be able to do it without the help of Word of Mouth. That's one. Two, we'd just like to say thank you to Sage One, who, as always, are our title sponsors, and they've been with us from day dot. And really, without them, I don't know if Suits and Sneakers would certainly exist in the way it does now. So, on both ends, with between Word of Mouth and Sage One, please go check them out online and support the guys who support us. Before you all go, don't forget that we are on Facebook, facebook.com/suitsandsneakers. We're on Twitter, Suits Sneakers. We are on LinkedIn. We've got a website, Suits and Sneakers. But really, most importantly, if you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and share it with other people. Stop listening to a fucking radio, for God's sake. This is Mark Sham, over and out. Until next time.